also like to thank Dave for joining us. I don't know how much contact the rest of you have had with him, but in case you're not familiar with his work, he is currently the executive in residence for the business management department, and he's also a local business owner who also participates a lot in community activism. So he's here to join us to talk a little bit about his own perspectives, where he sees the city of Boston, and he has a lot of unique insights, I think, to share with us. So what I've done today is I've prepared some questions for Dave that I've shared with him in advance so that we'll have some level of preparation and cut down on some of the general thinking time so that you can get the best of us. And I'm going to be asking him to share some of his perspectives from the city level and also particularly even more granular down to the neighborhood level, how he sees the situation unfolding, particularly regarding COVID-19. So the first question that I have for Dave, I'm hoping he can tell us a little bit about his history here in Boston. So how long have you lived in Boston and in this greater area? And what have you done here?
Hey, thanks, Ella. Thanks, Anna Kachin and Greg. I'm very excited to be here. This is a pretty exciting project for the city and for Wentworth. I moved here in 1988. I began attending UMass Boston. The route to UMass Boston, as those of you who know me, was of course not a straight route. I sort of wandered around a bit, tried to figure out what I was interested in doing. I grew up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, worked very active down towards the waterfront and in construction, and tried a bunch of different things before returning to college. I'm the first person in my family to go to college. I'm the first person in my family to own a home. And my family's always been very active in community, particularly my mom. So I think that was just something ingrained. We certainly didn't have a lot of material wealth, but we were expected to participate and help others. And I think that's something I carried in Boston.
Thank you. And so I know that you live in Dorchester now. How long have you lived in Dorchester?
So I moved into Dorchester in 1996, before Dorchester was in, where Dorchester is more in now than it was when I first moved here. What I was attracted to by Dorchester was how much of it was very familiar to me. It reminded me of New Bedford, very diverse, very community oriented, very proud of their neighborhood. Dorchester is still one of those places, if you have three community meetings in a week, you're going to run into someone at the local bakery who is going to ask you why you are not at such and such a meeting. I mean, there are ample opportunities to participate in whatever level you want, whether it's ground level planting in the park, community advocacy, political participation. I think Dorchester opens up a lot of opportunities. And I think that's where I discovered the secret about Boston is it really is a degree and a half of separation. I think when you move to a city, you have a sense that it's sort of the like the Wizard of Oz complex, where it's this Emerald City and it's so beautiful and it's not for me. It turns out like every organization, it is just a guy behind the screen pulling a bunch of levers that is just like the rest of us. So I think one thing that I'd love to come on Future Lab, which other think tanks have demonstrated, Ella's work at Elliott Church has demonstrated, you know, to demand access, the political folks here are very eager and available for you to reach out. And I would definitely use that mechanism as much as you can. It's a huge opportunity for networking. It's a huge opportunity in terms of your professional careers. So definitely reach out. It's not a limited access. Behind the scenes, they basically record who you are, do you vote, where do you live, and they make a little red dot where it is. And once they see that you're engaged, you get access. And I think that's important for this group to continue. Some of the other participants here, Kathleen, I see some others have reached out and seen those connections, especially through Ella's work.
Thank you. So for those of us who haven't had the chance to visit Dorchester, or we have only been there a little bit, I know you've talked to me in the past about some of the range of diversity that you've seen in the neighborhood, how certain parts of Dorchester are quite different from others. Could you talk to us a little bit about that from your perspective?
Sure. I guess the greatest glimpse, we're not going to have it this year. You know, I think of the Dorchester Day Parade. It is such a proud event in Dorchester. And you can literally start, it starts here at Lower Mills on the Milton side. And as you march down the entire length, you see the different ethnicities and the different groups that are so proud of their heritage as you're marching down. And it really is a diverse group, both economically and from ethnicity standpoint. You reach pockets where the flags are blazing. From half a block from here would be a Vietnamese neighborhood. Another block would be Caribbean. There's a pocket that would be considered old Irish and still identify themselves by their local passion, local parish. So I think the blend, just my neighborhood, which has become gentrified, has multiple city workers, police, firemen, teachers. It's a wide range as well as executives. It's also was part of the Dorchester Renaissance for political power. One of the campaigns I worked on was helping elect Linda Dorsinafori to the first Suffolk seat, which is the Boston seat. And it is the first time that anyone outside of South Boston took the seat. It is also the first time a minority woman of color took the seat. And that shifted the power to Dorchester. And that has been a real eye-opener to me regarding services that you can demand that were not coming here prior to that.
Thank you. So earlier today, I presented some information about the ways in which structural inequalities, such as residential segregation, income inequality, healthcare disparities, and access and outcome, all have combined to create this situation where the current pandemic is having really wide-ranging effects. And when we watch the TV commercials, right, everyone likes to say, oh, we're all in this together, right? The celebrities singing on their balconies in their backyards, right? But clearly we are all facing different realities, right? On one level we're together, on another level we're not so much. So I was wondering, could you tell us a little bit about how you have seen this pandemic playing out in Dorchester specifically?
Yeah, it's pretty upsetting. The word that comes to mind when I was thinking about this is access. Access in every way imaginable. Access to transportation, access to be able to go to city serving sites to pick up the things you need, access to education. So a lot of the folks in our neighborhood are considered essential workers, so they did not have an opportunity to stay home. There's a very high percentage of city workers in public facilities and transportation that were required to go to work. So I think all of us, by default, sort of, we all have to slow down and take a look at how important all of these jobs are as part of how it benefits us. But if you don't have access to internet or transportation, and you're not able to order your groceries to be delivered, I think every situation without access was a higher risk for communities of color running through the city of Boston. And just not having access to information, a great example with the state when they were doing the unemployment, the first a run of the unemployment for people there, it was only offered in English. So many people were not able to even sign up because they weren't able to access the information that was online. Students with Boston Public Schools that may be living in a small space with four or five siblings, where's the privacy for a student like that access-wise? If you can't use the library or another source in their house, what's their Wi-Fi quality? So I think what we've really seen is people that have been left behind I didn't hear your lecture, Ella, I'm sorry, but I did see your slides. And I think it's very fascinating that so many of the problems are the same. The analogy that I use with one of the programs in community is sort of like having dandelions in your lawn. You just mow them over and you've got your green lawn, but you actually haven't gotten to the root of the problem. And I think that's something that we're seeing in the stretch of Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, running down River Street. You can actually see the pockets in JP with the maps that John Hopkins and different groups have put out. It is definitely a very clear line across the country.
Thank you. So the next question then, I guess if you could expand on that a little bit. So what parts of Boston would you say have you seen that have been really especially hard hit by this pandemic? And why do you think those areas are seeing this?
Yeah, Mattapan and Matt, you know, Dorchester was listed as one of the hardest hit. I've seen some shifts with that. And I think it was because there are other neighborhoods that didn't have access to any testing. So some of this data is pretty irrelevant if you're only testing certain areas. So I don't know how you can decide what who's suffering more until you have testing out there that's equal. Mattapan and Hyde Park, I think, was a surprise. Also in certain age groups, I think what we're discovering and doing a much better job, and the city machine has discovered, a lot of people just weren't reaching them. They were just not getting the messaging. There were a lot of pockets of misinformation in the city that I think it took about 3 or 4 weeks for the city to get on its feet and provide a brochure that was actually dropped on people's porches rather than everything being online. And again, I think it's redlining districts. I think it's access to equity, education, information. They run the same lines that your slides pointed out. It's very disappointing to just be able to take the pandemic that you listed in the past and just change the banner and the result is the same. It's just very disappointing. People are doing much better. I just saw somebody listed East Boston. Yes, East Boston has really struggled. Outside of Boston, Chelsea and Brockton. We've actually reached out to communities outside of Boston through family members that are in Boston struggling. But yeah, you're absolutely right about East Boston.
Thank you. So I also know that you've been involved with several different community efforts to battle the effects of this pandemic. And I was honored to work with you for the one project to try to secure some laptops that you were able to deliver to Brigham and Women's Hospital for them to use for patient communications. So that was something we were very proud to be able to do. But I know you've also participated in some programs that are working on fighting food insecurity at the neighborhood level. So could you just tell us a little bit about some of the efforts you've seen from community groups, from businesses, large corporations, small businesses, and some of those you've seen as well as been involved with?
Yeah, it's you know, that's the positive side. I mean, I think we saw some of that after 9/11, where there was this, let's all work together and make things better. And then I guess that just wore away. Although I did get beat back today for the first time by someone, so, you know, hopefully we haven't lost our luster for helping each other. Early on, we have the city anger again with people beeping at you. But so larger organizations like BJ's provided the laptops for Brigham Women's, and that was pretty immediate. Costco's done a lot of work in our neighborhood. We are finding some of the larger supermarkets have been making donations to the community just in essentials, even sort of holding, you know, the toilet paper and the paper towels as an aside for local organizations to help distribute. I know that we've been able to sort of get one pallet set aside just for people that need some of these basics, like you know, sanitizer or whatever the current thing that is out of stock. What I've been very impressed with is the underground networks that that are out there, a lot are faith-based. You all will get a chance, I think, to speak with Reverend Hines, who can certainly enlighten you more than I can. But there are some people that will come to me for help because I'm not an elected official and I'm not a part of Boston Police. So they're establishing trust with people so that they know that they can come with you. Also, you'll find local helpers who in the past have been active helping the community who now are in need are a little bit embarrassed by that. So they're not coming to the traditional distribution centers, and we've really had to work hard to find networks to make sure they're okay. Counselor Campbell's office has this neighbor to neighbor system, which has been terrific. Age Strong is using their information to call seniors once a week and just make sure that they're okay. The mayor has a platform that's pretty interesting where you can volunteer with whatever skills you have. You know, you have a car, or you can deliver things on a bicycle, or you could mow someone's grass, or you could, you know, so I think that these are things that I hope continue on through this and after this, because I think we're discovering an awful lot more people are being left behind. I do know on a personal level, I had lost my mom in this, and it was just interesting. One of your sessions is going to be, and you talked about it in your slides, sort of the design of places. My mom was in assisted living, and just the kindness of providing laptops so you can see your loved ones. It doesn't seem like a big thing, but you'd be surprised. Just as students at this level, your basic skill level, which to you and your peers may seem ordinary, when I've seen those skills in community, they are considered extraordinary because people just don't have the same skill sets and the access. But the faith-based organizations, local restaurants here, have been providing food through different channels, word of mouth, just checking on neighbors. You know, please and thank you and how are you have much more meaning when the world slows down. And I think that means a lot to people.
Thank you. So I also wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on our local politics, because one of the great things, if for those of you who don't know Dave, is he knows a lot about politics, you can probably already tell. So we all know that Massachusetts is one of the states that has been dramatically impacted by COVID-19. And we also see Boston is taking some really bold steps. So Mayor Walsh is taking a much more progressive position in a lot of cases, I would say, than Mayor de Blasio in New York City, those of you who like to compare Boston and New York. So for instance, as soon as New York announced that they were going to cancel the Summer Youth Jobs Program, Mayor Walsh announced he was going to try to run Boston's program. So I think he's watching New York as well, engaging his own goals. And I know, Dave, that you've worked with Mayor Walsh and his administration on a range of projects in the past. And I'm wondering, what have you seen from Walsh, from his team, and from other members of council in terms of leadership during this crisis?
You know, you really learn a lot about people in situations like this. You know, it's very easy to shake your fist at the screen when a politician is espousing to a policy that you just feel strongly against. And you do start to forget sort of the human side of it. And I can just sort of, without getting into the details, that, you know, the governor and the mayor have not agreed on what needs to be done all the way through this. When I lost my mom and the mayor called, he had shared a story that I thought was interesting, that despite their differences, they always spend 15 to 20 minutes talking about, the mayor's talking about his mom and worried about her, and the governor's talking about his dad and worried about him. So sometimes we get lost in sort of the human level of this. Going back to what I said earlier about accessibility, I've been very impressed with how the city council has responded on a human level. And maybe they forget that the people that are calling in are not a number you know, sometimes they just forget that this is voter 203. They vote, they're an active voter. I think they realized that some of the city services and what they've done, and this was not early on, they were missing a lot early on, but they have recovered in the city. The 311 line, just distributing information. Ella, you and I talked about just coming up with sort of an app that knew where you needed to get supplies. Was it medicine? Where, you know, what was needed in a particular area? How could we be more efficient if someone needed medicine in East Boston, but they also need groceries? Why can't that be one person taking care of these things? So I think the city council members that were not quick to respond in the past to city concerns, it'll be something that will be remembered. They've had to do a much better job. And I think people remember the small things. You know, they all say politics are all local, the pothole and everything else. So this time we're talking about food and we're talking about supplies and medicine and access. And I think that the compassionate side of things really stood out for me. And also accepting, you know, a lot of times people don't like to admit that they're not doing a good job. There was some pretty harsh criticism in community meetings and at faith-based meetings and from faith-based leaders. And I do feel that the city has responded and continues to respond. They certainly could improve. And, you know, we have these conversations. I'm not always popular, but we can always do better. So I saw some notes coming in. Boy, the question for that's coming from Bradley, should corporations foot the bill on this? Well, that's a tough one. You can reach out to me, Bradley. We can talk about that. I can tell you what some people are doing. You know, Suffolk Construction, your earlier question, when no one could find the N95s, Feeney Brothers, Suffolk Construction, they all were donating those things. Hair salon, nail salons. You know, there was a lot of community outreach, just learning where these resources would be. I don't know what the right answer is on that, but I can tell you that as the wealth gap continues and is continuing now, I think it's an issue that will have to be addressed, should have already been addressed, and will be addressed probably in the next election. So that's a bigger one for this chat. And then I saw a note. Regarding the sidewalks. Yeah, that's a real struggle. You have pockets of neighborhoods that don't want to wear masks and expanding sidewalks going forward design wise is interesting. I know that the Department of Transportation is discussing that, and there are plans currently. There was a master plan for Blue Hill Avenue that they are now considering redesigning based on these issues. So you all will play a pretty big role in that. We had a project earlier this year with the future of triple deckers through John Ellis's class, and the plans from that are being considered for developing city lots. And I really think this future lab will be also used as a model for some of the ideas that you all come up with.
Thank you. So I wanted to turn my previous question around a little bit. So let's say Mayor Walsh or Governor Baker came to you and said, "Hey, Dave, you know, what advice do you have for me? How might I be better addressing this situation? What should I pivot on a little bit? What advice would you give to the mayor and the governor?"
Yeah, so I don't want either one of their jobs. We do joke around more so with the mayor about what's it like to always be wrong, you know, so using that as a jumping off spot, I think it's something that came up the other day that I learned. I mean, one of the things that I like about participating in Wentworth is I always figure, you know, I always meet another incredibly talented person or someone that has an interesting insight that I'd never considered. And there was a chat through the Capstone Project with, I know her first name was Ginny, it might be Ginny Grimen, I think she's at Wentworth. And she was the head of the Big Dig for project and risk management. And she said something that was so obvious to me after she said it. And I think that that's, I would grab that snippet from the interview for the mayor and the governor, which was, in many cases, people felt the Big Dig was a failure. It was massive overruns, a much higher percentage of death and injury on those projects than anyone had considered. Something that would have been noted in the modern social platform age, but wasn't as discussed earlier on. And she said she wished through the project that she had access to listening better to people on the ground, because she found that over 50% of the things that went wrong on the Big Dig, she could have fixed if she had listened to people or heard access to those conversations. So I think that would be what I would say. You know, in hindsight, you see what happened in nursing homes. Hey, it's very easy to say, why weren't nursing homes given PPE earlier on? Why wasn't this seen as such a dangerous spot? I mean, literally was, you know, dry grass for at-risk populations. And it was something that is obvious after the fact. So I would say that taking the time to listen to people's problems, trying to see it from their perspective first. Our last future, that was City Lab, that when we did interviews, the greatest compliment I felt we had as an organization at Wentworth, we had three people say separately in different ways, you asked us what we thought before you told us what we should be thinking. And I think that's something that both the mayor and the governor need to do. I mean, you're always at the whim of your staff. You need good people around you. They might not be sharing information, or they might not think the information is as valuable as it is. So I think getting out there and listening to people, they did do their first civic association meeting in Lower Mills. And I know that the city is planning on doing more of that and listening to civic associations, what people are actually dealing with on the ground that they might not know about. That doesn't show up in, you know, technology and data are great tools, but they're tools. You know, if you still need the human element and understanding where people are coming from. So
thank you. And then the last prepared question that I had for you, Dave, it's obviously easy for us to feel helpless, kind of overwhelmed by everything that's going on around us. But what role do you see for innovation? Like from your perspective, with city government, with small business, with Wentworth, what are the things that are standing out to you as pockets for innovation?
Yeah, I think as dire as this sounds, and as you tune into those channels and you look at the upper right-hand corner and it's the death count and the infection count, you know, it's clearly hard to stay optimistic, try to divide it into being a Tigger or being an Eeyore. I think I'm definitely a Tigger. I think there's tremendous opportunity now. No one's really been in this situation to this scope. And I think one, the lessons that you bring to the table, Ella, from history are a great starting point. Small things, innovation, small businesses, a small business up here doing takeout started to factor in using their cameras. And when you placed your order, they asked you what kind of car you were in so that they could see you pull into the back so that they could bring your food out to be more efficient. I mean, I thought that was just a very simple, interesting thing to do. What we did at my mom's place and then was followed in other South Coast assisted living and nursing homes, where the community hour was 2 o'clock. So we recorded and broadcast in Elvis Hour or Frank Sinatra Day or Bingo. You know, just trying those little things and trying to keep people that some sense of normal have such an incredible value. So I think from a technology standpoint, again, going back to what you think are ordinary ideas are extraordinary. How do you plug in these simple tools that you all use in your daily lives that small businesses don't have access to? You know, small businesses are just trying to survive. They don't have time to sort of figure out what needs to be done, and your insights would be very, very valuable for them, even on a basic level. Corporations, you know, you're talking about design. We're seeing, you know, what will all this mean from the moving industry? We're moving a lot of people out of commercial spaces because, frankly, they're not coming back. You know, if you needed 30,000 square feet before, you do the math. What's the actual square footage that an organization is going to need with 6 feet and everybody's been working from home just fine? What the T is going through in terms of how many more cars they're going to have to run just to bring people in, and will anyone take the T when you're doing the 6 foot distancing? So there's so many things that it really is, the limit for you is really your imagination, because every aspect is going to change, and it's going to be your generation that leads it.
So those are all the formal questions that I had, but I'm sure that the students have a lot more questions to ask you.
So there's one more in the chat that we hadn't looked at yet, and I'll read it. That's from Kyle as well. For East Boston, much of the neighborhood is made up of essential workers, and we talked about it briefly. Making public transit more dense and the spread worsening than most of Massachusetts. What would you recommend for solutions to combating this? Would an expansion of public transit be better? More community outreach, reach out for accessible testing? So you've touched on it already, but I want to go back, since we just talked about the T, to this question of the neighborhoods who have a higher percentage of essential workers. Like, which programs should move in right now? Like, what should happen right now? Is it the testing? Is it additional buses? I mean, stuff can happen, right?
Yeah. So that it's a really good question. So I was invited to a call for the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, and it was specific to transportation. And, you know, what does this mean? We were trying to provide different alternatives. You know, one of the solutions that we had proposed, just from a psychology standpoint, we weren't happy with the T before. We found it incredibly inefficient. And now, with this virus, will people go back on the T? You know, do they, if they feel that they don't have faith in being on time, are they going to suddenly think, wow, it's going to be sparkling and safe? You know, so the psychology of this is a real challenge. They are looking at buses. They are concerned the first models for the return of traffic when we do get to that phase of opening is peak traffic, right? Everyone's going to come in a car individually. Uber's going to be popular again in some way with a standardized cleaning. Maybe people will bring their own cleaning things to the Uber and make sure that they clean everything off. East Boston and Mattapan are the two highest areas for city employees. So it's a really good question. The T has this thing called sort of the Goldilocks idea. They think that people will take part of the T, that they'll have to run more trains and buses. They're hoping to reduce traffic and increase temporarily lanes of traffic to additional bus lanes so that you can move people. There'll be less people on the buses, but you can move people faster. You see dedicated bus lanes throughout the city, but they're actually thinking in a two-lane road of making two bus lanes in one car road to discourage people in cars to take the bus and come into the city rather than Uber. But all of this, you know, there were some brilliant ideas and brilliant minds there, and they are thinking about this. And the entire session ended with a bunch of people saying, we really don't know. And I think that's where there's opportunity. I see there was somebody else down below too. I missed that one. From the business perspective, 40% of small businesses say they'll be forced to close. Yeah. I don't have an answer for that. I think that's very reasonable. I know how close to the margins the mom and pop shops and spas and the local stores and restaurants operate normally. So I'm very concerned about it. I really don't know what the federal government is going to do with that. I mean, I know that there's pressure for the state to reopen. I know there's pressure for more money. It goes back and forth. I mean, that money will need to be paid back. I also know that some of the loan process, unless you have an accountant, it is just incredibly overwhelming to just fill out the forms to get help. So the first loan rollout was a pretty significant failure. Most of the people that received the money were large corporations, and the small businesses have not been fortunate with that. The Boston Resiliency Fund is doing some amazing work, but that is if your rent, don't forget, this all happened at peak economy. Rents were the highest, the price per square foot was the highest. So it's not that hard to just have an insurmountable amount of debt as a small business without 3 months of income. So I'm not sure how that'll turn out.
I think there's an even more specific example about the 116, 117 buses that Kyle posted. Dave, do you see that?
Yes, I do. I can tell you that's part of the meeting that they recently had. That was one of the routes that was talked about, the 39 going out of Mattapan and Ashmont Station into Ruggles was another one. So they're very concerned. So what they're thinking of doing is increasing buses, but they're really not sure what people are gonna take. I think you're gonna see a lot of buses with very few people. I did see the note about the free metro. That would be, that did come up in the conversation. But keep in mind that the T was already losing money when people actually paid. So I'm hoping that the city of Boston considers that as a way to encourage people to take something other than their personal vehicles. The one interesting option, Anakachan and I had talked about, we had proposed if dorms were not being used or low volume, low occupancy hotels, that we might sit with the unions and discuss a 4-day work week where people would stay in these places at a discount subsidized by the companies so that workers were not commuting back and forth, and they would have a four-day, 10-hour work week, and then, or split shifts, Monday and Tuesday they're in, Wednesday they're home, Thursday and Friday is a different group. We're really not sure, but all these ideas that you're coming up with are being discussed, so you're on the right track. And if you come up with an answer, call me. Quickly.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that we thought a lot of things were sort of written in stone, and now all of a sudden it seems like a lot more is up for grabs, a lot more things are being questioned, and it's an incredible opportunity with all the hardship that it's creating. It's also, it allows us to somehow question how all this stuff is administered and delivered, and I agree, I think a lot of ideas are necessary. And also a lot of research is necessary. So for example, Olivia is asking about innovations about implementing sanitation lights and venting. Mm-hmm. I think that's a piece of research and a sort of innovation work that definitely will have to happen. And I'm sure there are places that have thought about it, but mm-hmm. I don't know that my confidence level is very high for the tea. As you said, it was especially filthy compared to other means of transportation all over the world. So there's a huge jump necessary there. And the personal, how you see things. I mean, a lot of these things are symbolic. So I heard a show about hotels that just put out these spray bottles of disinfectant everywhere saying, well, when people see them, they'll feel better. No, you know, it's like, and so it's the same with many things, that there's sort of a symbolic component. Do you trust this? And then there's a real component. How disinfected is it really? And what are the, you know, do we trust the technology that deals with it? And so I think those are all questions that the different teams can think about, research and start addressing, that go much further than just spaces allocated.
The sanitation, sanitizing light, very interesting. That was discussed about 2 weeks before the pandemic. There is someone that I know personally that was speaking with Derek Cassio in industrial design. And he was working on a light chamber specifically around this on a small scale that was going to be rolled out to workout centers and gyms. He had had someone in his family that had a bacterial infection based on working out. It was quite serious, and that he created these cases where you could sort of insert dumbbells and smaller tools and things that you'd use in a gym to be sanitized by the light systems. I do think the T is looking at that. Some of the early models that I had seen were these that you saw in Europe and you saw in Asia, which are the almost like the foggers that you've seen them use with mosquito control. You know, people are in hazmat suits and they're spraying the stuff. You know, Boston is also a tough city. When we talked about that at a community meeting, someone said, what are you talking about? I'm not going to take the tea. They weren't cleaning under the seats when it wasn't a pandemic, you know? So, you know, these are the kind of things that you're going to be facing for community to bring back trust. But we need to be able to get people into the city.
I just wanted to add, when we're thinking about ventilation, I know this is rather grim, and I'm often the Eeyore. Dave always tells
me not to be such an Eeyore.
But I'm saying, you know, look at Wentworth and our janky dorms that didn't have air conditioning. I have to say it's fascinating that as air conditioning has now come up as a negative with the possibility that it's circulating contaminated air, I'm wondering if some of the things that held us back as a school might actually, and other places around the city that were held back that were kind of deemed terrible and old fashioned, could become in vogue again. That's the best pep talk I can give you.
Yeah, I think did you send me that article? There was an interesting article on, just on, similar to a Legionnaire's disease, you know, where the light aerosol spray coming through ventilation, how it would impact restaurants, what the spread area is. Yeah, these are all things that are gonna be in your lap as designers. I mean, these are the things that, the race is on. The opportunity is phenomenal. People are not able to think of all these things at once, and they're trying. I do have a friend in Florida that went out to a restaurant, and I asked, well, how did you do that? And it was these little plexiglass booths with like a little slot for the worker to slide the food underneath. So you almost had your own little cube, which I don't know. I'd rather eat in the backyard. It wasn't convincing to me, but that's what you're going to have to overcome. Some restaurants it took them 4 weeks to come up with a takeout plan. Some restaurants just can't do it, well. We have a couple of Italian restaurants here that just decided not to do it. They thought the quality of their pasta, homemade pasta going out, was just not something that translated into a good meal for people at home.
Well, just taking something that's ready to eat on a 20-minute walk or car trip can make it pretty unbearable because it's steamed basically after, so it's not the same thing. I would like to encourage the teams to maybe come up with a few more questions before we wrap up. And so the topic being impact on society, or comments from your end, what you've seen, where you're interested in, and you can unmute yourself or type it.
Kyle, I see your question. I actually don't know the answer to that. I'm sure that is very true regarding Mass DOT. That is another line that lacks clarity. Who is in charge of these new challenges? You see that across the nation. Is it the president? Is it the Congress? Is it the governor? Can the mayor turn down the governor? So all of this is part of discussion. It breaks down in organizations like this. You know, who are the mask police? What is the danger and the psychology behind shaming people? You know, so I've seen my daughter's just turned 18, and she had one of those car parades. And it just was, you know, okay, so you're running to cars and you're going back and forth and, you know, people are handing you things. And it's just all these worries that you haven't been able to come up with. But that's a really good question. I don't know who will be in charge in that regard.
If I could just tag back onto Bradley's question about the economy, right? Was our economy actually thriving, or was it corporate America? So when we look back to the Great Depression, right, that's a point I always make to students. Before the stock market crashed in 1929, we often have this image of the Great Gatsby and all the spending and all the money, and it was great. But at the same time, half of American families were living in poverty, right? Yeah. And so when we talk about that period, we talk about what were the cracks underneath the surface of the economy. And I think that income gap, that disparity, right? The billionaires versus the people making $10 an hour. I think definitely the question of how do we measure peak economy, and to what extent do we go by the Dow? Do we go by the performance on Wall Street, or are there other metrics we should be looking at? We definitely had peak employment, everybody had a job, but a lot of people had three jobs because the wages were so low. And so economists and sociologists will differ on how they measure those figures. So really good question.
It is a good question. I can tell you the answer to that was, I'm a bit of a geek with data technology, and I've done a few businesses. And we usually see, especially if you're tied into moving, you tend to see what's happening on the ground. You know, so you're almost a social economist. People start telling you things. You know, you start to hear people aren't tipping as much. Corporations are not paying for a full pack and move, even though they were really, on one hand, desperately recruiting talent because we're at full employment. Small businesses and large corporations were complaining that they couldn't find good people anywhere. And it was very strange to me that that was what we were seeing in the press, and we were seeing what was happening with the Dow. But our data was showing that things were staying on the market longer. High-end luxury apartment places were saying, oh, well, Ella, if you have a friend that you could get to come here, we would give you $500 off. So we were seeing those cracks. Because of our community work, we see people working three jobs at 20 hours at $15 an hour trying to cover a one bedroom in Dorchester or in Mattapan or Mission Hill. I mean, look at what the students are paying. You know, if it's a three bedroom on Mission Hill, more than likely they're paying $1,000 to $1,200 a room. So, you know, though that's not affordable for